Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. And today, I'm joined by Fred Trotter. He's the CTO for CareSet Systems. Fred, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I wanted to kick off with one of the things that I know you are heavily involved in, the Save the Data campaign and Save the Guidelines specifically, the AHRQ content that was essentially destined, I want to say, for the dustbin, but maybe you could share a little bit of the background, the lead up to that, and what you got involved in.
Sure. So there was two websites. One is guidelines.gov, and the other is qualitymeasures.ahrq.gov. Both of them were hosted by AHRQ, they were some fairly substantial repositories of best practices in medicine. Two types, obviously. One was kind of obviously guidelines in the traditional sense, and the other was, I think, more valuable for people like me, quality measures, which is metrics that you could run on data that you might expect to find on EHR to find out whether or not healthcare provided by a group or by a person or by an institution or by even a region was effective. So the backstory on this, we had been and remain somewhat concerned that the current administration would have taken the approach that that would be against the open data strides that we made under the Obama administration. And I should admit at the start that in general that has not been the case. So in general, the Trump administration has been very positive towards open data. They have been relatively transparent. There have been things that positions that they've taken outside of open data that I disagree with, but I have to give them credit in general for supporting open data in healthcare, and CMS and HHS have in general done a pretty good job. Now, there's been some notable exceptions like this one. And of course, the problem with this one is that AHRQ for this work was defunded. The work was defunded under the Obama administration. I don't think the actual administration did it. It was actually a congressional act that defunded it. And again, I don't actually understand. It's hard because I can see the surface reasons why things occurred, and I don't know the underlying political reasons, because to be frank, that doesn't interest me. Nonetheless, AHRQ, these two websites, was a tremendous resource, they were going to be scheduled to be shut down. Very problematic. So what we did, along with a group that found each other and loosely coordinated on Twitter, there was actually, I think, three or four different parallel efforts that were coordinated to back up the data. We put our backup, we scanned everything in, and we had a spider running against the two websites. And you can find them still on GitHub, and we also created AHRQ qualitymeasures.careset.com and AHRQ guideline.careset.com, both of which, and I imagine if you're doing show notes, you can put links to those up in your show notes, but the links to both of those are available from my blog. And if you click them, you'll find some repositories that look frankly, pretty terrible. And the reason, of course, is that we didn't bother to replicate the CSS. It's just the HTML that we reposted. I think we have the CSS. We just didn't bother to try to make that work and make it look like it did. But the content has been saved. And some of that content is extremely valuable, not found elsewhere. So we also replicated it to GitHub. And in fact, what our websites are is a checkout of GitHub of the material that we did. So it is now open data in in the traditional sense. If you are an open data person, and many people who, if you're listening to this because you're a fan of Nick, you might not know me and you don't know that I'm an open data person. If you're listening to this because you know me and you're following my work, thank you, all 12 of you. I really appreciate it. And also, it's really cool if you want to take a look at that from an NLP perspective. So there's a lot of natural language there that's been written. And when we got into the mirroring, we found that there were three or four or five different sub-sites that were there and were available. And one of them, the expert commentary, was, you know, kind of full of some high-level commentary from AHRQ folks on some things that was really interesting. We couldn't find it anywhere else, so we were very happy to get that up. You know, I have not actually taken much time to pay attention to these kinds of to what's happened politically since then. I mean, my role is very simply to make backups of the data, and we did that. And so I should look into what's happened since then and find out. The reason that I care about this very specifically is, and I hope this is the right way to characterize my work, and that the things I'm about to tell you are things that I hope they're true, not necessarily sure that they are, but I am not just a data scientist, I'm a data journalist. And as a data journalist, what I am most concerned about is that data scientists and data people, unfortunately, have this bad habit of kind of working on whatever they've got. So for instance, if you want to study the first name choices in the United States, there's an excellent data set that shows what first names have been chosen. So there's all this work that's gone into first names, but who cares, right? I mean, for the most part, first name analysis is not terribly interesting. And in fact, there are interesting, even the interesting results in the first name analysis are not terribly useful. So for instance, recently the first name analysis has shown that there is a precipitous drop in the usage of names once a personal assistant starts. So for instance, Alexa, Siri, and Cortana are not popular first names anymore because they're the names of our AI interfaces. And that's interesting. And that's probably some of the most interesting results you can get out of that first name database. However, it's really not the kind of thing that has a huge impact on our lives. And so the number one thing that I'm concerned about as a data journalist is not really necessarily what is in the data or what examining the data. We do some analysis, but we also cooperate with other participants, more traditional healthcare journalists, sometimes healthcare researchers, and sometimes clients who actually pay us to go find data. But for the most part, what we are focused on is making sure that the right data, the data that you really need to make big decisions in healthcare, is available. And so this is a data set that has not been well studied and really deserves to be. And since you seem interested, I will continue to say that this is the kind of work that IHI does a little bit, Academy Health does a little bit of this, Cochrane Collaboration does a bit, Wikipedia does a bit, which is to kind of do a meta-analysis of what science has released and determine what is, in fact, the consensus. And there are a lot of clinical issues where what is done in clinical practice is the basis of what you learned in medical school. If you went to medical school on the East Coast, you do one thing. If you went to medical school on the West Coast, you do the other thing. And in many cases, it's very difficult to know what the right answer is, or even if there is a right answer. And then there are things that we've actually studied and we actually do know the right answer to, and are despite the fact that we know the right answer, it's not well disseminated. And so in those cases, those interesting cases, that's the type of data that was available on these websites.
So that corpus, if my understanding, and I recollect this very strongly because I was part of that group. Whilst I didn't contribute from a data scientist or a technology standpoint, there was a lot of connections going on. It was something that I applaud the capabilities of social media to bring the right people together. I know that there was competing issues, and you even tried to coordinate some of that because you were all hitting the same site, so it was causing some issues. But that corpus is a long-standing corpus. I mean, I don't know what the history to it is, but I know it goes back a substantial amount. Had you not done that, would we have lost it completely?
Well, it's a good question. I hope the answer is no. I hope one of the other efforts would be successful. I mean, the difference between the approach that I took and the approach that others took is that we were very interested in making so that there was little search engines. And I apologize if this is boring to your readers. I'll try to make it interesting again in a second. But there are little search engines in the websites. Like you go in and you type something and something comes out. And it's actually fairly difficult to find a way to make sure that as you extract the website, you're not just getting all of the web pages that kind of show up incidentally, but also you're kind of replicating the functionality of the search engine. So we had to do some work on our part to make sure that we understood and were exercising that system well enough that we could reliably get the tags and the other kinds of data artifacts that were underneath that search engine system. That was really important to us because we wanted to replicate it as a searchable resource. And so that was the focus that we took, and other people took a different approach. We tried to put people in a position to do data work on the results of the archive that we did, and other people took different data approaches. So I hope that what would have been true if we had not done anything is that one of the other backup efforts would have been effective and would have found those results.
But I mean, to be clear, I don't know, those three groups, came together and there was some coordination and so forth. But if they had not backed it up, we would have lost the data would have disappeared, essentially. This was, vaporized.
Well, that's true. So one of the things that people just kind of assume I celebrate and donate to, and everyone should donate to, as one of the kind of key resources on the internet, archive.org's efforts. Archive.org is a tremendous effort to make sure that we have backups of all websites, and their efforts are really, really good. But these little search engines that I'm describing is precisely what trips them up. Yeah. So we spent time actually using the archive.org's API to figure out what they already had to make sure that what we were getting had not been gotten, and so that there was so that we were kind of, working on this. So you're correct, and in fact you're perfectly correct, because there were things that we got that were not part of the kind of standard archive. And in general, things not being part of the standard archive is a substantial problem when you look at resources like this. So we do have kind of methods to back things up and make sure that that resources are available. It's interesting, as a person who's just interested in making sure that things are not lost, and it's really fascinating, right? We have this digital culture, and one of the benefits of this digital culture is that we have this liquidity. So theoretically, we shouldn't lose anything that's really, really important, and yet we do. And so whether you're talking about standards like this or healthcare records or other things in this vein, thinking about how to be protective, and this actually might be an ideal segue into the next segment. When you think about cybersecurity, you're thinking about the long-term integrity of resources. In fact, the good CIA, when you think about cybersecurity, CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, is not always on your side, but the confidentiality, integrity, and authenticity, access control, some people debate about what the last A is. CIA is an acronym that talks about making sure that data, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. The I and the A in that acronym are making sure that the right stuff keeps around. And it's amazing because we sometimes aim our best digital archivists at things that aren't really important, right? If you've got 15 pictures of your kid at the last time he, you know, he or she was doing something like playing on the lawn, or maybe your pet, you know, people go out and they'll take 50 pictures of their dog in the front yard, and those things are, you know, going to be worth with us into the next millennia, because they just kind of caught up in our really good digital picture backup schemes, at least theoretically. And so you probably should, for the sake of your sanity, have a single picture of your dog that you keep, but we don't necessarily need all of that data. So we have a lot that's kind of useless cruft. Even the pictures that you take when you're testing the camera out, and you're like aiming it at the, you know, corner of the room or something, it kind of floats around, right? And yet at the same time, we have critical data resources about guidelines of patients that sometimes slip through the cracks. It's infuriating and quite a problem.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Fred Trotter, the CTO of CareSet Systems. We were just talking about the save the data and the AHRQ, and we were just pivoting now to cybersecurity and that persistence of data. And I know, Fred, you've been involved in the work with the government and some of the guidelines around cybersecurity. Tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved and some of the surprises that you found in that whole security arena for the healthcare domain specifically.
So the cybersecurity has been an interesting journey for me. So I had been a cybersecurity expert and worked as a cybersecurity professional before I got into health IT. And that was the career that I left to come in and come back actually to my family business, which had been a business my grandfather started, doing healthcare technology. And it was great because, you know, cybersecurity has always been a concern in health IT. And so those were good credentials to switch careers. But I had thought I had left that behind until I was asked to submit my application for sitting on the healthcare industry cybersecurity task force. And what happened is that before he left office, and I imagine that President Obama imagined this was a report that would be useful to a hypothetical President Hillary Clinton, but he had passed legislation that would caused a group to be formed to answer five pretty difficult questions about healthcare cybersecurity. And I applied for the board, as I do every time I volunteer for the government, in exactly the same way, which is, I'd be happy to do this unless you can find someone better, and then please choose that person, because, you know, I really don't want to necessarily, but I'd be happy to if no one else can be found. And so I was asked to join the group to represent patient community interests, and I turned out to be one of few people who had extensive experience in healthcare interoperability. For some reason, we didn't have great representation from the EHR community on the task force, so I kind of represented the patients and represented the people who were trying to do things with EHR all at the same time. So I got on this group, and you can imagine it really was pretty interesting, because what I do for my day job now, you know, the company that my grandfather started has gone away, and now we do healthcare data journalism, and we basically sell a really good map of the healthcare system that we create from Medicare claims data. So that's what I do for my day job, functionally, right, is to make a map of the healthcare system from claims data. But that gives me a very special insight into, you know, if using that map, maps can be used for good, maps can be used for evil. So one of the things that I'm concerned about, of course, is, well, who's going to, you know, what happens if someone uses my map as a map that we release publicly, or replicates our work to make the really good map that we don't necessarily release publicly? What if somebody uses that against the healthcare system as a map for what to attack or what to go after? And that was my little concern. my thing that I was a little bit freaked out about. But you can imagine there's, you know, I cash at 16, I think. I think it's something in the tune of 16 other people who were on this, formally on in the group, as well as a cluster of advisors that were from the government who might as well have been on in terms of their qualification, really excellent people. So it's about 20 people in a room all coming together and really kind of sharing that their deepest fears about what might go wrong in cybersecurity. We spent the first half of the year doing that. And it was not a fun experience in the sense that, you know, if you take the worst thing that I'm afraid of and then you take the person who Terry Rice, for instance, was from the CISO from Merck, and what he's afraid of has to do with how the pharmaceutical industry could be attacked in a way that would really hurt people. And then you take my fears and his fears, you kind of make it together. It was just this, you know, amalgam of, you know, really awful conversations. And as we, most of the things that were really kind of combinatoric attack things did not happen. Most of the interesting and simple things that we were concerned with did happen in the year that we were actually reviewing these things. So first of all, one of the things that we were super concerned about, for instance, was the Muddy Waters, something like what happened with the Muddy Waters. And what that was is we were thinking one of the ways that you can attack the healthcare system with a cybersecurity threat is that you take a zero day, and a zero day is a term that means a cybersecurity threat that's never been seen before for a medical device, and you release it to the public and you short the stock. And your motivation is that you short the stock of the medical device manufacturer. That actually happened for the first time. That happened while we were studying, and we were super concerned with ransomware. And of course, the NHS attacks happened kind of in this time frame as we were writing and finishing things up. So many of our, you know, scenarios that we were concerned with, we saw play out actually while we were writing this. And the theme of your show is incrementalism. And if I could dip into your theme, this is a somewhat morbid way to look at things. But I think this is the kind of, my uncle is an emergency room physician and, you know, I'm not nearly as morbid as he is. Right. So, but when you talk to people in the healthcare industry, it's like, well, you know, 100 people were given the surgery and 5 of them died. Meh, you know, it's a difficult thing, right? That's actually pretty good. Is only 5 people getting killed for a serious and complicated surgery or something like this. So when I hear and when we have heard, I will not, you know, slander my fellow task force members to say that I think this way. Although I think probably some of them do. But when I hear that there's a cybersecurity threat that kills 5 people or something else that happens, I'm actually somewhat relieved because we need an order of magnitude more attention on cybersecurity and healthcare. And when only a few people die and encourage more attention in it, from my perspective, like, well, we got off easy. We really, that sounds awful, and it is awful when somebody dies or somebody's injured by a cybersecurity event. But things are bad enough in the landscape that when we see only a few deaths, I think the real experts are somewhat relieved, which is, again, a morbid way to look at it. But we need to have some events in order to get people to pay attention, and we want those to be relatively small. And so far, all things considered, they have been. Anyways, I thank you for letting me ramble on these kind of things, but that's what it was like to be in the healthcare industry. We wrote a very nice paper and released it, and it has been very well read. Since then, the work has been continued by multiple parties who are frankly better equipped than I am to continue it. I have started work on issues with Facebook and some of the cybersecurity problems and privacy issues that they have, but I think that might be another podcast.
Fantastic. Well, Fred, no surprise, I always seem to run out of time. Unfortunately, we have 2 fascinating topics. I think, you know, certainly the work that you do is a great contribution to the healthcare system. I think your passion for open data sharing, the ability to use that data, and indeed the transfer or the coming in from the outside as a security researcher. I actually didn't know that. I knew you had cybersecurity in your background. I didn't know you'd done it that way, which is fascinating to me. So it just remains for me to thank you for joining me on the show and sharing some of your insights. Thanks very much for joining me, Fred.
I really appreciate you having me, and thank you so much for making me think about different ways. I think that incrementalism is a super interesting way to focus on the parts of the healthcare system that matter, but sometimes get ignored.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.